everyone, and welcome. I want to thank you all for being here today. My name is Maria Kosinski, and I am with Greeno Brand Storytellers, a local public relations and integrated marketing agency. On behalf of my team, I would like to say that it was an absolute pleasure to manage the public relations campaign on behalf of the Boston Book Festival for the first time this year. I think like everyone here in this room today and at the festival, Greeno loves a good story. So our work is really about crafting stories on behalf of our clients, and so it seemed quite fitting to work with the Boston Book Festival. So I'll turn it over to Robin in a second, but I also wanted to say if you enjoy events like this, I invite you to check out WBUR's City Space just up the road. They have great discussions and performances and all sorts of things. So thank you again for the opportunity and for being here today. I'll turn it over.
Thank you. Oh, well, we are on. How long has this been on? Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this beautiful space in the Boston Book Festival. It's so wonderful to see so many people here. I'm introducing myself, so my name is Robin Call. I'm reading my own self. And I have been connecting readers and writers for almost 20 years through my podcast, Reading with Robin, author events, and my Authly. My monthly author series, which I host with my daughter, Emily. It's called The Cardigan Connection. And so I'm going to introduce our three authors. They're going to each speak for a few minutes about their books, and then we'll jump into conversation and then open up for a Q&A. So be thinking of those cues. First up, Christopher Castellani's fourth novel, Leading Men, for which he received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, and the McDowell Colony, was published by Viking in February of this year. Leading Men was featured in Publishers Weekly, People, Entertainment Weekly, Interview, The Washington Post, and was an editor's choice of the New York Times. Castellani is on the fiction faculty of the Warren Wilson MFA program and the Bread Loaf Writers Conference. He lives right here in Boston, where he is the artistic director of Grub Street, the country's largest and leading independent center for creative writing. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you.
Next up, Roxana Robinson is the author of 10 books, most recently of her novel, Dawson's Fall, published by FSG. Robinson has written three other novels and three collections of stories.
Five other novels.
What?
Five other novels.
Okay, you check your, this is sorry. You sent this, actually. Her work has appeared, five other novels. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Harper's, Tin House, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, The Boston Globe, Vogue, Salon, many others. Four of her books have been named Notable Books of the Year by The New York Times. She currently teaches the MFA program at Hunter College and lives in New York. And Stephen Rowley is the best-selling author of Lily and the Octopus and The Editor. His work has been published in 19 languages. He has worked as a freelance writer, newspaper columnist, and screenwriter. Originally from Portland, Maine, he is a graduate of Emerson College and currently resides in Los Angeles. Welcome to our authors. You're in the hot seat, Chris, because you're next to me.
Oh, no.
Go ahead. No, I'm fine. So tell us a little bit about Leading Man.
So, Leading Men is technically, I guess, an alt historical novel that, because it features real people, most notably Tennessee Williams is one of the main characters, and a few other real people of that set in the 50s and 60s. But the real focus of the novel is Tennessee Williams' partner, Frank Merlo, who they were together for 15 years. It was during that time that Williams wrote most of his great plays. And I was really interested in the relationship between these two men and how Frank Merlo affected Williams as a writer and as a person, and how their relationship played out over the 15 years that they were together. After Frank died, Williams never had another big hit in any way that was close to what he had when he was with Frank. They were together, as I said, for 15 years. Frank died of lung cancer in 1963. And so the novel is told mostly from Frank's point of view. And then there's a whole other half of the novel that is narrated by a completely fictional character named Anya, who is an actress, sort of like a Liv Ullmann type character. And it's a lot about her friendship with Frank and all three of their relationships. So set in Italy in the 50s and a little bit in New York in the 60s and a little bit in Boston and Provincetown in the present day.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Yep. And we have all the books are for sale across the hall afterwards. I would be showing you these beautiful, they're all gorgeous. Roxana.
So my book is called Dawson's Fall, and I'm calling it a biographical novel because it is, everything in it is true, but I wrote it as a novel because as a novelist, as a biographer, I wrote the biography of Georgia O'Keeffe, so that form was very familiar to me. But as a novelist, I couldn't give up the two great tools that novelists have, and one is dialogue. A biographer just, nobody knows exactly what was said in any conversation. And the interior monologue, as a biographer, the best you can do is to say, she must have thought, which is a terrible thing to say. So I wanted the interior monologue and I wanted the dialogues, but my great grandparents lived in Charleston, South Carolina after the Civil War. And I come from a long line of New England abolitionists. Harriet Beecher Stowe is my great, great, great aunt. So I had always thought I had one relationship to slavery until I started looking into this little Southern twig of our family. And Francis Dawson was an Englishman who came to this country to fight for the Confederacy. And he married Sarah Morgan, who had grown up in Baton Rouge. And Frank Dawson was really interesting because as an Englishman, they had banned slavery 30 years earlier. And he came because he thought the South was a brave little group of states who were standing up to the Northern bully. So his point of view was totally different, and he stayed on as the editor of a newspaper which he had founded, which still exists, called the Charleston News and Courier. And he became a liberal voice for the New South. So he became this really interesting lens through which to consider the idea of slavery in our country and its legacies, its terrible twin legacies, racism and violence. And as I wrote the book, it took me 5 years, I thought that I was writing a book about my family. And I learned through those 5 years, both watching the news and doing the research, that I was writing a book about my country.
Wow. Thank you. And Stephen.
Yeah, my most recent novel is called The Editor, which is about a young writer in early 1990s New York who gets his big break when his first novel is acquired by Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis when she was an editor at Doubleday. For anyone who's not familiar or doesn't remember the details, she went to work as a book editor in New York after the death of her second husband. And she had this really sort of prolific third act to her life where she had this 15-year career, first 2 years at Viking Press and then the bulk of her career at Doubleday, where she edited more than 100 titles. So it's not really something we remember. Just this year has been 25 years since she passed away. But it's not really among the top 3, 4, 5 things we remember about her. And ultimately, I think this was the most interesting time in her life, as she'd sublimated so much of herself to these two marriages and to sort of duties to, in different roles for our country, that this was a time when she was able to step out of the shadows and build an identity for herself. So it led me to talk to a lot of her coworkers, writers who had worked with her, and an incredible amount of research, including reading the books that she had edited during the time that this novel takes place, just to try to forensically recreate her desk and what was the subject she was interested in at the time and what might have been at the forefront of her mind. But it was a really, really exciting to try to sort of recreate this time, and perhaps one of the most famous women in our country, a time that we know not as much about.
So you read, thank you, so you read some of the books that she was working on?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Which were some of them?
Well, there were a number of books on Egyptian culture and art. She did do novels, like in this book, so I read a novel that she had edited. But she also did a lot of sort of coffee table books and art books. Her interests were varied for dance, art, fashion of the Russian czars, anything. They were as wide and varied as you can imagine her interests might have been.
Thank you. The idea of the editor, and I'd like you all to speak to what that relationship is like and the trust that you have with your editors and where maybe there was conflict of which way the story should go and, you know, that really building on that trust and where the story was better or took a different direction because of that. Chris.
Oh, gosh. I'm always first. Remind me not to
right
sit next
here.
To you
no,
again.
No, never. You'll have to remember that all by yourself.
I can't see you, Chris. I'm moving forward so I can watch
you
storm.
I know, but you want to, like, yeah.
I wish I had a good story about this one, but I mean, I'll tell you about this one in a minute, but for my first novel, I really struggled with my editor because she really wanted the ending to be happy. She really wanted the lovers in the novel to be together at the end. And the whole point of me writing that first novel was for them not to be together in the end. But I said, well, you know, we don't want to have a bummer of an ending, you know? And it's like, well, that's not really what I was, it's not true to the story.
Life's a bummer sometimes.
Exactly. Yeah. Ultimately, I stuck to my guns on that one. And there are certain things I know we all do. We all sort of compromise on certain things that aren't necessarily crucial to our, you know, understanding of the book, but there are certain things we won't
right.
compromise on, you know. And then for this book, I mentioned that I have two narrators, and my editor very smartly felt like they were two separate of characters, mm-hmm. and he really wanted me to really build their relationship, create more linkages between them, and write more about their relationship and how it played out over the years. And so that was really, really sound advice and really helped to, I hope, unify the book a bit.
Yeah.
So sometimes they actually have smart things to say. Which is nice. Yeah, so.
I love that. Yeah, and you know, as a reader, we're seeing the finished product.
Right.
And so that to me what is so fascinating about what happens and goes on behind the scenes where the story could be totally different. Mm-hmm. And you know, I love hearing those nuggets, so thank you.
So, we all have different experiences. I've had a number of different editors, and one of the things that happens is when you write a novel, it's as though you are creating a continent. You know, you have made Asia, and you can land on it, and you can go anywhere mm-hmm. in Asia. You can go to the steppes, you can go to the cities, but that whole continent belongs to you. And the editor, this often happens with me. When I wrote Sparta, my last novel, it's about a young Marine officer who comes back from Iraq, and he had a really hard time in Iraq, and he has a really hard time coming home, and so I was making the reader understand how difficult it was to come home from Iraq, and my editor said, you know, but we don't know what he was like before he became this angry, troubled person. I said, oh, right. So you just turn the spotlight on that part of Asia, and it mm-hmm. all comes up. So mm-hmm. then I wrote the scenes in which he is this charming, wonderful young teenager and college student, which, I mean, I knew all that about him. I just forgot to put that in the book. So Sarah reminded me that that part of Asia was also part of the continent, so I could bring it up.
I love that. Thank you.
Yeah, my editor is a wonderful Korean-American woman who's very small in stature, and I laughed because I begged her for the sales conference. I said to blow her hair out like Jackie, a big lampshade of hair like Jackie Kennedy, and put on the enormous sunglasses,
yeah.
And she wouldn't do it. So sometimes you can't get your editors to do what you want them to do, but she did push me through writing this novel to give Mrs. Onassis real narrative purpose, so that by the end, we're not using her as a hook in the way into the story, but why is she, in the end, the only natural editor for this book within a book?
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that was really, made the book, I think, what it is, and that that came from my editor. But, my background was in screenwriting. And so when I sold my first novel, my editor was giving me some notes, and then after the note said, but I defer to your authority. And I almost fell out of my chair because in years of pursuing screenwriting, no one had ever deferred to my anything. So books it is.
I want to talk about emotional truth in storytelling and sort of how the writer is fearless on the page maybe and can be edited and how that maybe pertains to your storytelling and what you maybe didn't want to include but felt like it would drive the narrative better and had to sort of go there. Start with Roxana. Give Chris a break.
So this book was really confusing for me because as a novelist, I have always started out, my short stories start out with the ending. I know that my short stories start out with some very troubling moment that I'm writing towards. My novels start out with the beginning, with some confusing idea that troubles me and I can't understand. And the way I understand it is by creating this group of characters who are engaged in it, and they write the story. They tell the narrative by their interactions with this problem. But with this book, it was a novel, but the narrative was already written for me. So my task was to tell the story like a novel, although it was actually a biography.
Yeah.
So it was a nightmare, actually. It was really the most difficult.
Sorry to bring that up.
Yeah. Because how much do you put in, and how much importance do you give this and give that, and how much backstory do you put in? I mean, I knew everything about Frank before he had arrived in this country, and then he arrived in 1861, and then he didn't meet Sarah till 1874, but the story doesn't really start till 1889, so how much do I put in? I thought it was all fascinating, but it's my family, so you might not find it that fascinating. So, you know, I was struggling with this idea of editing the stuff over and over, and sometimes as a novelist, at the end, when you finish this 2,000-page book, you think, okay, the first 1,500 pages are useless. So just start on page 500, and it will be fine from there on. But I couldn't do this in this case, and my editor, nobody knows this saga as well as I do, so she kind of rolled over. So I don't know. You'll have to tell me. Was it worthwhile putting in that first stuff? It was a much more confusing process for me than any other novel has been.
So was this a novel that was sitting in your mind because it's a family story and because you knew it would be such a daunting task, or like at what point did you decide?
I never thought about it because, as I say, Harriet Beecher Stowe is my great, great, great aunt. I felt my family had said the last word we had to say on this subject. I would never write about it. First of all, because she'd said what I would have said, you know, if I'd been in her position. And secondly, because I thought it would look as if I was, you know, trying to fly on her coattails. Or whatever you do on somebody's
coattails. Well, that's a common, you know, why not? If you have coattails.
Well, I didn't want to be seen as somebody who was trying to, you know, follow it. But it was the other side of it that suddenly, and I can't remember, with every other book, I know the moment in which I became interested or I started writing it. I think there were two scholars who were writing a book about Dawson. They got in touch with me, and they started getting, and they sent me letters that Sarah had written, and I wrote a piece about him for the New York Times. And in our family, we saw him as a hero. But the more I thought about him, the more I thought I was ambivalent, because he was part of the Southern supremacist system. Those were all his friends. He'd fought with them for 5 years. They were his brothers in arms.
Sure.
And yet he stood out for the rule of law and the rights of the new black freedmen. So who was he? So no, it's not something I'd been thinking about it. But it was very daunting because I had to deal with the Civil War.
That so little thing, yeah.
I tried to circumvent that because I couldn't.
I need to tell your story.
Take the whole thing.
Thank you.
Yeah, emotional truth is something that's extra challenging when you're using real life historical figures in your work also. Because there were times when I was like, oh, it would be great if Jackie would just do this. But Jackie would never do that, you know? And so you have, darn it, you have to find another way around it. But I found too, you know, particularly with my first novel, which was called Lily and the Octopus, which is about a sort of middle-aged man who wakes up one day and finds that he believes there's a small octopus stuck to his dog's head, which is weird, admittedly. I decided, initially the octopus came to me because I knew I was writing a story about attachment. and how difficult it can be to let go. And so having a tentacular metaphor of sorts made sense for that. But you know, I knew from page one, I'm asking the readers to trust me and go on a journey for this. So my mission was to be, as you know, present the absolute emotional truth of this, no matter how weird on the surface the narrative was getting. And if I just stuck to that emotional truth, that I could trust the reader to come along with me. And I think there's something, the more specifically weird that you get sometimes, it also conversely makes it more universal, because no offense to all of you, but we're all weird in our but in our own way.
Yeah,
so you know,
yeah.
I have people come to me over like, oh, I never would have thought an octopus, but you know, my dog went through something like this, and you know, we called it the hippopotamus or the giraffe. You know, like who knows? But sometimes the more emotionally specific you can make something, it has the effect of opening it up and making it universal.
Relatable.
Yeah.
And connected.
Yeah. Did you have this challenge with writing like 10, for instance? I call them 10. After reading your book, I call Tennessee Williams 10 because I feel like we're friends.
I like that.
We're so intimate.
So intimate. Like, did you find yourself ever sort of trapped in a corner because you couldn't get your character to do
I always
you...
knew. Well, actually, I loved, one of the things I loved so much about writing this book is I loved having those constraints that you talked about, like Jackie would never do this, or Dawson couldn't have done that, or because I mean, writers, when you're writing from whole cloth, you do have that entire continent, right? And sometimes it can be paralyzing that they can do anything at any time. They can be anyone. Maybe this character I've created isn't a 25-year-old woman. Maybe they're a 40-year-old man, or maybe, you know, so it takes away all those. The sort of dirty little secret is that writing about real people is actually like much, much easier than writing from whole cloth. At least that was my experience. Because again, you've been given so much of these characters already. You've been given these constraints. I mean, I'm Catholic. I like constraints. I like to work within a system, you know. And I like to feel a lot of guilt about doing this in the first place.
So it all worked for you.
It all worked for me. I liked knowing. So I didn't write. I'm not in Tennessee Williams's head and through any of this novel. I had nothing to add, in my opinion, to our understanding of Williams as a writer, as a person. There's been infinitely, you know, there have been so many great books written about him, his own memoirs, his own notebooks. It's all there. I have nothing to add to it. But Frank, his partner, in my opinion, has not been kind of written about enough. And so he was the focus. But there's not a lot written about him. I read their letters. I read biographies that mention him, that did other biographical work on him. So I had certain constraints, and obviously I had the constraints of what he looked like when he lived and died, what it was understood his personality was like, what came through. And I loved working within those, because for me, like, the primal scene of this book was I was reading a biography or a memoir about Tennessee Williams in the late 90s, And I just came upon this scene of this 40-year-old Italian-American working class guy who was a truck driver, a veteran, an aspiring actor and dancer, who was dying of lung cancer in a Manhattan hospital in 1963, waiting for Tennessee Williams to come visit him one last time before he died. They were estranged at the time. And I thought, and then I read that they were together for 15 years and all this, but how in the world could a working class, Italian-American, gay guy like me, you know, be the partner of this great American playwright? So for me, it became like a process of like investigation into that emotional truth, into that relationship, to sort of figure it out. And ultimately, he's my interpretation. He's not the real Frank Merlot, just like you're not writing about the real Frank Dawson and the real Jack Yeo.
I am.
Well, you are, but it's still an interpretation. But it's still an interpretation.
Yeah, you can do all the research in the world, and it's still, there's a percentage of
it.
That's your imagination.
Right.
Also.
You always have, I mean, otherwise you would have called it a biography. You wouldn't have called it a novel, right? I mean, it's going to be an interpretation no matter what.
Well, so is a biography, yeah. Actually.
Exactly. I totally agree.
And as
yeah.
we all know, yeah. The way you tell the story is the story. Mm-hmm. So when I wrote the biography of Georgia O'Keeffe, right. I felt like you.
Right.
This is great.
Right.
This is writing a novel without having to do any work.
Right.
It's all there.
Right,
the
right.
characters are there. Right. The plot is there.
Yeah.
All I have to do
yeah.
is the research, which was fabulous.
Yeah.
I got to read other people's mail for 5 years.
Right.
But the way you tell the story is
absolutely.
The story. So the way
absolutely.
I told O'Keeffe's life was just as informative as the way I told the Marine's life.
Right.
And what you leave out and what you put in and the way you describe that conversation
yeah.
is your understanding of
absolutely.
The character.
Right.
So we're
I know,
all
that's true.
Thing.
I get frustrated when people think of biographers as these kind of neutral
right.
beings. Like I just read the Susan Sontag biography, and which I loved, loved, loved.
Uh-huh.
And it's been criticized for being too biased or something like or
well,
have the person brought their own perspective. Of
imagine
course,
that.
Of course,
yeah.
you did.
You brought your own perspective.
Right?
You're
anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
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 And
anyway.
And you talk about all this research. I would like to know what was like so surprising. Mm-hmm. Maybe didn't make it into the book, or it wasn't going to drive the narrative. But you were like, and how much do you, when you're researching? Do you? I mean, I know you're intense on your research, but do you just like drift off? And you know, is it a good time to also go down a bit of that rabbit hole? You know. When do you just say, okay, I got one. I got it.
I think that's
Mrs. Onassis had a very sly sense of humor, which I was kind of surprised about. But I heard some wonderful stories about, well, for instance, one was she was with a coworker traveling. I think they were just on a little commuter shuttle, a small flight from New York to, who knows, you know, D.C. or Boston, whoever knows. But they were the last aboard, she and her coworker, and so... you know, if you're seated on a small plane and you look up and suddenly Jack Onassis is walking down the aisle, you know, imagine all eyes are up on her. And she leaned into her colleague and she said, "Look, Bill, everybody knows you." Which I thought was very funny.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's great. That's really
Thank
great.
Thank you. I love
That's
that.
Really great.
So many things. I mean, you can change the narrative completely by including something. You can change the reader's view of your character completely by including one thing. One of the things that became apparent to me, so since Dawson was the editor of the Charleston News and Courier, he wrote editorials sort of every day for 25 years, so I could find out what he thought about everything. And miraculously, for my research, if you subscribe to today's version of that paper, the Post and Courier, it gives you access electronically to the archives.
Oh, wow.
So I could get on my computer and every morning and
wow.
go to 1878 and see what Frank Dawson had said
wow.
that day.
Wow.
So I did that, which was a huge, huge luxury. But one of the things, so I would go to specific dates when I knew he had said something that was important to me. But I'd have to scan the paper, the way that the mechanics of it mean you have to see the whole page and you have to find the column and you have to, so I was looking at a lot of other things and I became aware of the fact that the newspaper had these articles about hideous events of violence that were so troubling to read, and I would skim over them and get to the part I wanted. Finally, it dawned on me, not only had these taken place in the South after the Civil War, Dawson had thought they were important enough to give precedence in his newspaper. I didn't have the time to read every other local Southern newspaper, but I understood that Dawson thought violence, he was anti-violence and he wouldn't carry a gun, was a prime problem in the South. And that alerted me to another whole issue, which was the heritage of violence from slavery. And I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't been able simply to scan these pages and see one incident after another of people shooting each other, stabbing each other, hanging each other, and this just this orgy of violence that took place that Dawson was documenting, and that was part of his character.
Wow, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, the research for me was it was a joy because I really was deep in this book right around the lead up to the 2016 election and then right after. And I just would so much, I was so happy to retreat into 1950s Portofino, Italy, up with these glitter whiffs, all these like Truman Capote and Tennessee Williams and John Horne Burns and all of these writers and starlets and celebrities and all of that. So I was sort of doing a deep dive into that. And I loved every part of that type of the research. I also found as I was researching and talking to people that almost like, I cannot tell you how many people wrote to me and said, I was a, fill in the blank. I was a young man in his 20s or whatever who struck up a friendship with Tennessee Williams. And I have all these letters from him that show you. I mean, there's so many people who he had relationships with, whether it was sort of flirtatiously by letter or in person. So one of the most fun conversations I had was with a guy in Chicago who called himself the last living lover of Tennessee Williams, and we sat for hours in a coffee shop, and he gave me very intimate details about his life. Not that Williams wasn't giving those details about himself as well, but with anything, with a letter, with a even a journal entry, certainly in memoirs that he wrote, he's always constructing himself, right, for the audience, whoever that is, whether it's the audience of posterity, the audience for the letter that he's writing it to, the audience for a memoir. So it's always hard to get with people that we're writing about a kind of unfiltered, unconstructed view of them. So talking to these people who knew him and knew their set and getting the other side of the story was, to me, the most exciting part of it.
Is that the original slide into my DMs was
slide
into the U.S. Postal Service?
Yes, I mean, any young man who sent him an admiring letter, he would write back, not any, I shouldn't say, but many young men who sent him like admiring letters, he would write back and say, oh, come meet me in New Orleans,
They were groupies,
and,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Most people don't write to their groupies and invite them to come to their house.
Not that we know.
But he did that fairly frequently, so in his later years.
Fascinating, and thank you for setting it up nicely for the next question, which is these books have all been out for a bunch of months, 6 or 7 months or less. But what have you met, who have you met with when you're doing events on the road, and people who do come up to you and have like intimate knowledge of some part of your book or take a piece of your book that maybe wasn't as front and center, but they have such a deep connection to it? I always like to know what you hear from your readers, your groupies.
that's interesting. Everybody wants to know if the family or they'll ask me, what gives you do you have the right to do this? And sometimes it's a legal question. They want to know, do you have the right to use a real life person in fiction? And my response is, Jackie O was perhaps the most well-known person, so the definition of a public figure. So yes, you do have the right, but often it's a moral question too. What gives you the right to do that? So and that's something each artist, each individual artist has to grapple with. But they want to know if Carolyn's read it, and I don't know. I mean it only as the utmost compliment. So when she did pass away, her son came out and gave a statement. My mother was surrounded by her family and her books. And to the level that books were important to her life, you can't overstate that. And this is a part of her life that not a lot of people, especially younger people today, know about. So to be able to shine a light on that, I hope that the family would like it. The singer Carly Simon has a book coming out later this year about her friendship with Jacqueline Onassis. She actually published 3 children's books that Jackie had edited, and they developed quite a close friendship. So I had spies from the bookstore on Martha's Vineyard say, oh, Carly Simon just came in and bought your book.
Oh, I love that.
So now I'm waiting to hear what Carly Simon
likes. I love that. Yeah. That's so cool. I love spies in bookstores, too.
They're good,
they're
good
everywhere.
To have.
Because Dawson only had 2 children, I had a son who was gay, who had no children, and he had a daughter who was my grandmother. And beside that, and there were only 3 children from that. So I know everybody in the family, and they died, 100 years ago. So people have come up to me in the audience and said, or they've raised their hands and said, how has the family responded? I mean, is there anybody in your family that's upset about this? I said, you know, it's over 100 years ago. Nobody's upset.
No one's haunting you.
No one no one's about to give me a lawsuit, I hope. And the family's all dispersed. I don't really know most of the people who were involved. And then after I said that, somebody came up and said, I'm your cousin. I'm your sixth cousin on that side. But the best someone I never heard of, if you're here, said, come and say hello afterwards. But the more frequent response I get is that because this is dealing with the fundamental American problem, which is how do we deal with the heritage of slavery, which implicates every white person that was in the country before the Civil War. Everyone was complicit, everyone benefited from it, and every white Southerner was deeply complicit. And if you're a descendant of one of those white Southerners, how do you deal with it? Do you not mention it? Do you hate your ancestors? How can you integrate this idea? So the book is sort of about that. It's how to deal with this hugely important American subject. And I have had people come up and say, my family is from Virginia, and this is something I've been struggling with, and thank you for a way of looking at it. So I feel as if I'm not just writing about my family, I'm writing about a big issue that a lot of people are affected by.
Yeah, I always get the moral question, like, what gives you the right to do this? And I really don't have I don't have any guilt about that. You know,
no,
I feel
guilt
like,
there.
No, I mean, that's what, you know, that's why there's those two beautiful words on the front of the book that say
it's
a novel.
It's a novel.
You know, and so it is, and again, it's an interpretation, you know. Yeah. But at the same time, I did go into it with respect. I didn't go into it to tear down any reputations, to expose anything, like anything, you know, untoward or whatever. So I really went into it with love, with true love for these characters. So I felt like that really helped. I was concerned about Williams scholars who, you know, live their lives thinking about, you know, every detail of Tennessee Williams' life and how, like, what fault they would find with this book. And thankfully the publisher actually had it vetted by a Williams scholar, and they were very happy with it, so that was cool. I was also worried about Frank Merlot's family, who are, again, working class Italian American people like my family, and how they would feel about me, you know, appropriating the lives. But then I learned that, you know, Frank died in 1963. Williams gave the eulogy at his funeral in Peterstown, New Jersey. And then they buried Frank, literally, and then they buried Frank, you know, spiritually, and in the family, they never spoke of him again. And so that his ancestors, many of them didn't even know that he was in their family until one of them, a guy named Joey Merlot, who is Frank's great-grandnephew or something like that, discovered this, and he is an aspiring actor and dancer himself, gay, looks exactly like Frank, and is now an actor in New York and writing about Frank himself.
Oh,
right?
Wow.
So, and I've heard from the family that they've all read the book and they enjoy it. So I feel okay with that.
That's awesome.
But my favorite, if I can be sort of starfuckery for a second.
Please do.
My sort of favorite moment was when the actress Kathleen Turner, who played Maggie the Cat on Broadway in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof for years, I was at a fundraiser and she was there. And she came up to me and she was like, you know, she has this really deep voice. She's like, I read your book. She's like, I loved it. You know, and I was like, oh my God,
that.
It's Peggy
That's
Sue.
Awesome.
You know, it's Serial Mom, you know. I was so excited.
From the chandelier.
Yeah, so, and
That's
it was Maggie.
Awesome.
I mean, that meant a lot to me
that
too.
That is so,
so anyway,
awesome.
Anyway,
oh, I love
so
that.
Was
that.
Cool.
Thank you
that
for sharing
that.
That
was my favorite celebrity moment.
That is awesome. One of my favorites was when your book was shown on the Seth Meyers show.
Oh, God, that was
and
crazy.
And Fred Armisen was explaining.
Yeah.
Have you all seen this? When he judges a book by its cover?
Yeah, yeah.
I know I got the 3-minute thing. There was a follow-up question to that, which I will not ask. But I will say that all of these books are, who's in a book club? Usually, yeah, these are all fabulous book club picks. And I was going to ask you to say why, but I'm just going to, in the interest of time, tell you what they are. So it's like the cake on the Today Show is made. And we're going to open it up. Thank you so much to all of you. We're going to open up to questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Who has a question? Are we going to those? microphones there? Who has a question? We'll just, no. Does anybody have a question? Yes.
So the question is, I had mentioned the difference for me between a short story and a novel, and with a short story I start with the ending, and with a novel I start with the beginning. What drives me to write a short story is a moment in time that I find particularly powerful and troubling and exciting and whatever. Sometimes they're joyful, sometimes they're devastating. Sometimes it's something I've heard about, sometimes I've been there, sometimes it's observer, sometimes a participant, but it's a moment that I find absolutely revelatory and overwhelming. And so my job as a writer in that set of circumstances is to create a vehicle. It's like driving a four-horse team in a carriage. You are creating all the characters, you are creating the speed towards which you're driving towards that destination. You have to keep all the horses in line. One of them wants to buck, one of them wants to trot. You're keeping all of them, and your job is to get the character, the reader, to inform the reader with everything she needs to know about these characters, this set of circumstances, and this action, and this conflict that is driving you towards this unbearable destination, which is overwhelming. And my job is to deliver you at that destination, to that destination, with this huge flourish, all the horses moving at speed, the carriage in the right track, and to get you there in it so that you are, it's illuminating and devastating at the same time. The novel is exactly the opposite. The novel starts with, why the fuck are we in Iraq? What is it like to be somebody who is sent out across the wire at 2 o'clock in the morning in an unarmed Humvee, set out to go on patrol until he gets blown up and have the medics say, we're not diagnosing traumatic brain injury because it's too expensive to treat and it will remove personnel which we can't afford. So you go back on patrol. Why are we there? What is it like for them? And what is it like to come home? That was the beginning of that book. And I knew nothing about the Marines. I'm a Quaker. I knew nothing about Iraq. So my job was to learn that continent, create that continent for myself, and find out what it was like for this man to be there and to come home.
Thank you.
I didn't know the ending of that.
I can take that real quick.
Sorry.
Yes, the question was about using dialogue in historical fiction, whether it's a story or a novel. How much dialogue do we take? Can we take from letters, journals, etc.? Is that fair? Okay. So for me, like I really, you know, I read, as I mentioned, letters and all of that, and journals from the characters for whom, you know, I could get those documents, and both for information, but also trying to get a sense of the rhythm of speech and of any kind of idiomatic, you know, cadences to their voice. And for Williams, when I was writing Williams's dialogue, I also have dialogue from Truman Capote, which was incredibly daunting to try to think about writing dialogue from Truman Capote for either of them, but especially Capote with his vicious wit and all of that. I thought for me the most unmediated dialogue would come from the journals. Because even though you're constructing yourself in a journal in a way, it's the closest to, I think, like someone's real thoughts. So I actually would lift certain phrases and lines and put them into the dialogue when necessary. And then most often I would take them out later, and then work around them, but sometimes I left them in, and that was okay. I got permission from the Williams estate to use clips from, you know, from his journals. But for the most part, I really tried to invent it myself based on what I knew in the content and also the form of the way they spoke.
There was a powerful moment at the end of the story, which I won't spoil, but where Jackie really needs to come in and say that, and that I lifted from an actual quote of hers because I just needed that to be as authentic as as possible. But other than that, through the research, you get an idea of the rhythm of their voice, the types of jokes that they might, you know, all this sorts of stuff. Something that benefited me, though, was a lot of people had said that Jackie had this sort of zen-like ability to get you to realize and share something about yourself that you didn't even know. But also, she was a very private person, so she would get you to do that without sharing very much of herself.
Like a therapist.
At all, like a therapist. Yeah. So, and that made my job a little bit
wow.
a little bit
easier. Thank you.
Do you want me to answer too, or that's enough? Is that
no,
enough?
It's never enough. Go
so, for me, it was even more daunting because it's the 19th century, and I actually met Hilary Mantel. I mean, that's the real problem for historical fiction. Anything before the 20th century, you don't know how they spoke, and what we have is letters, which is very different from spoken language. So part of my resources were the Brontes and Trollope, and Dickens too, but reminding myself that in those novels people spoke very informally, very forcefully, they were funny, they were quick. It's not like the letters which are for my dear little Austin, let me explain to you what the weather has been like here in Herefordshire. But I said to Hilary Mantel, I met her at some literary thing, and I'm a huge fan of those books, and I said, well, how did you get the dialogue? Because the dialogue in those books is so contemporary. You never feel that you've gone back 500 years to a place where nobody talks like us. It feels as though they're in the room with you. And she said, well, it was difficult. Yeah, we knew that. She said, we had to go, but this is before Shakespeare. And Shakespeare is really the earliest source we think of. So we had to go back to sources before Shakespeare, which made no sense to me. I don't know who she's talking about. And I told another writer this, and she said, yeah, she didn't want to tell you. It's a mystery how she did it. I did just what Chris did. I drew on diaries and letters a lot to find out what they were thinking about. But my other source was a kind of a secret one, and it was the fact that they are my great-grandparents. And so there were things that I grew up with not knowing that they were sources, that Frank and Sarah were sources. And in one of the memoirs, everyone in that family was a writer and wrote memoirs and published books. And in my grandmother's memoir, unpublished, she said, my father used to go to a concert or something like that, and he'd come home having never heard the music and sit down and play it on the piano. And my scalp tightened because that's what my father did.
Wow.
So I don't think I would have dared do this book and written a historical novel about people who were not my kin, because I could understand them in a way that I wouldn't have been able to. I wouldn't have dared do it, but they were part of who I am.
How are we doing for time? Are we a question?
Yes, my question. Yeah, is there a microphone there?
Yeah,
that's so awesome, so we can hear it. Thank you.
Oh, I'll stand on tiptoes. So obviously your main characters are pulled from the real world. For your side characters, though, how do you decide who else you pull from the real world and who else you make up?
Not to spoil anything, but Jackie's actually a supporting character in this, because it was so powerful, you know, and I wrote all these scenes where she sort of was, and she sort of overpowered the story that I was trying to tell. So one of the tricks is knowing when you're using real people too, like how much is the right amount and how much, when to pull back as much as when to highlight them. And you can become very enchanted with your research. And like you were talking about earlier, sometimes it's really nice to have all that research, because if you're looking at a blank page one morning and the writing's not coming, you know, it's great to have all sorts of stuff to sort of, you know, as a prompt for writing that day, but sometimes it's too much. I did sort of, there was another writer that Jackie edited, and I worked him into a party scene just by first name and by the subject matter of his book, just thinking it was so random that, and then, someone came up to me and it was like, oh, I'm good friends with the person you referenced in the, and he was delighted. So I was like, oh, God, thank God that he's not going to sue me, because he's not the definition of a public figure, per se.
Right, that's so cool.
I had, my original concept for the book was to have it be about Frank in Tennessee in the 50s and another couple, John Horn Burns and his partner Sandra Nancini, also in the 50s, about both of their relationships. I was going to talk about each of their relationships from the perspective of their partners, because John Horn Burns is a writer as well. And I had done all the research for that, and it was set completely in the 50s. And it was going to be almost like a compare contrast of like this couple is like this and this couple is like that. And I was writing, I had a lot of pages written, and then I realized that compare contrast is not really a plot, you know.
Yeah.
And it didn't really work as a story, you know. I worked in my lit classes, but not in not as a novel. And it really felt very claustrophobic to be in that world with them, and I needed another character to kind of bring some air and bring some perspective to the story, and I wanted it to have a contemporary element, so I invented this other character completely out of pretty much whole cloth, invented from a scrap of a letter that Truman Capote sent during that same month where they meet, and where he said, the big scandal in Portofino this summer is that there's a Swedish mother and daughter who are sleeping with the same fisherman. And I thought, one of those women is my character. I have to write about her, whoever she is.
Cool.
And so I created the character from her, completely fictional. And only the way to answer the question is, only when I created this fake character was I able to really see the real characters almost for the first time. Because I was seeing them from my perspective and from biographer's perspective throughout while I was writing it, but it's only when I created this other fake character, fictional character, and saw them through her eyes, almost like mediated through her, that I was able to sort of see them clearly. I don't know really what that means, except that's what happened.
I love that.
Yeah. So.
So for me, I didn't create anybody fictional. I really felt, because it's my family, because they're real people, I felt a real moral obligation to tell only documentable facts. Because this period is so wild in American history, and because there are so many documents that are accreted around this period and my family, who were all hopeless writers, that there's so much material, every person, every exchange, every incident in the book is real. And people come up to me and say, so how much did you change? What's not real in your book? I say, did you read the ending of it? Everything is real. And there are totally crazy people and totally crazy events. And they are documented. They're in the police testimony. Wow. So I didn't have to invent anything.
Wow. And am I right, Stephen, that all in your book, everything in the book could have happened, right?
Yeah.
Or
absolutely.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
And like, so she was, you know, she had another relationship with a man for the last 10 years or so, for like Maurice Templesman. So you know, I'm like, oh, I want to write the scene where she goes home from work at the end of the day, throws her keys down,
yeah,
and
yeah,
like unloads on,
yeah,
you
yeah,
know,
yeah,
like. But no, because one, he wasn't a public figure for me. So, and also, I know she was a very private person, so she would have hated that.
Mm-hmm.
And I let that dictate my, you know, I want to respect that privacy. So everything, again, could be sort of documented.
Right.
This is all takes place, you know, in an office, you know, the scenes with her largely in an office setting,
right,
in a, where it could be witnessed or,
right,
or to be, you know, and I tried to respect, you know, think about, you know, I don't know that this is always the best way to come at it for to create art, but for her particularly, I had so much respect for her that I didn't want to cross that line.
Right.
Such reverence.
Yeah.
So we have the last question. Does somebody have one? Yes, last question. There's one right there. Oh.
That's okay.
I can't, the lights are blinding.
Yeah.
Sure. Logistical question.
Will all the books be available over at Copley and so we don't have to carry them with us, or are they only here?
The only thing I can say is I know they're, I don't know, Karen, are they? They're available in the Boylston room directly across from us, and I will say that autographed books make the best gifts ever. The holiday season is tick, tick, ticking away, and so to get autographed copies of books for your list, I would suggest that. As far as COP, I don't know. They're over. They're probably all on the square, right? But get them here, then, and the authors will be going to sign in the back. And I want to thank Chris and Roxana and Stephen and the Boston Book Festival for having us. This was wonderful. Enjoy the rest of your day, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.